Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1275.PR2225, certificate number 48391, Tama Bell Brass. Hi, Nabil.
Hello, John. I love that intro. I've never thought I'd be talking to somebody about a snare drum on the internet.
Did you not, though?
I try to keep it offline most of the time.
So for people listening along, well, I should tell you, Nabil, you know, we've had now about a dozen or so guest hosts, and there are a lot of people who in the comments like and appreciate the fact that I'm talking to new people who have never been on a microphone.
Ah.
But then there's a very small subset of people that like it when I talk to somebody I know already.
Okay.
And in particular, somebody that has used a microphone before.
And someone who knows you, I dare say.
And that's right. And someone who knows me. And you qualify on all accounts.
All right. I'm already feeling good. This is going to be a great show.
So for people who don't know the history of Nabil Ayers, I'll just say briefly. I won't make you introduce yourself. I'll introduce you. Former drummer of the Long Winters, or rather, you were never fired and never quit.
So does that make me current?
Current drummer of the Long Winters.
Yeah.
Label head. Why don't you explain your job as head of a multi-headed hydra?
Yeah. I'm the president of Beggars Group, which is a group of five separate independent record labels. I ran one of them, 4AD, for 13 years in the U.S. I live in New York and then moved into this role almost 4 years ago, where now I oversee the sort of umbrella company, if you will. So the labels are not under me. I would say that I am responsible for overseeing the company that helps those labels put out their records.
And what are the five labels?
It's Matador, XL, Rough Trade, Young, and 4AD.
And do they call you a president or a CEO?
President is my title. It's a pretty good title.
And why? It's a great title.
Yeah.
You know, I'm of the opinion that there's a little bit of CEO inflation and that a lot of CEOs are actually just presidents of companies.
Right. Huh.
And
I don't know many CEOs, and sometimes I think I should have tried to go for a CEO title, because isn't that the same thing?
That's the thing.
Corporate executive officer, right?
Yeah, sure. Let's call it that. Corporate executive. No, it's something else. What does C mean? It means chief executive
chief,
officer.
All right. See, that's why I'm not the CEO. President. They're like, let's just give him president. It's more simple. He'll understand what that means.
Well, you know, and that might even be problematic these days.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, are you a chief? Actually, of the two of us, you're probably more.
Can you even say that? Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Part of your journey, because you're also an author and you published a very well-received book about your journey getting to know your dad and exploring your identity with a lot of different people. And as part of that, didn't you discover that you were, I mean, this is the problem in America, right? Everybody wants to be a little bit Native American, but you discovered right. that there was actually a component of that to your life?
Well, no, I think I discovered the opposite. My dad, who I never knew, the jazz musician Roy Ayers, I was always told by my mother that he was 1/4 Native American. Therefore, I was 1/8 Native American, which, as you say, I think there's a lot of Americans like to say, like, oh, yeah, I'm 1/8 Native American, point to their cheekbones. And when I finally met him in Seattle in 2005 or six, he told me the same thing. And he said all of his sisters have, he had three sisters who have the high cheekbones and were part Native American. And when I did 23andMe, finally, it told me 0% Native American. But I mean, what do they know? They're out of business, right?
Well, sure. And they've probably sold your information to, right. to Amazon and to the Chinese government.
Yeah. And they're probably injecting some Native American blood as we speak.
I think probably that's true of 98% of Americans who point at their cheekbones and say that they're 1/8 right. Native American. Did I say Native American? I mean Americans.
Americans. I'm 100% American.
And you also have a podcast called Identified, which is exploring people's identity journeys. Is that
yeah? It's really fair fun. Assessment? I mean, that is a fair assessment. It stemmed from me writing this book, a memoir, which I jokingly but also seriously say is about me, because that's what memoirs are. And I did a lot of book tour events. You hosted one in Washington. It was tons of fun, and treated it like I was in a band because that's my background. So traveled a lot, did events everywhere and anywhere people would have me, and got kind of tired of talking about myself, but remained interested in talking about the subject of family and identity and genealogy and all that stuff. So the podcast is really me interviewing other people about their stories, and it's been pretty fascinating.
So treating it as like a tour, like we would have in the band days.
Absolutely.
Did you sleep on a lot of floors? You seem like you're a little bit old.
It was a little sleep on couches. It was maybe a little nicer than that. Yeah. And
Oh, so it was like us at the end.
It was us at the end when we were staying in the Ritz-Carlton and the Four Seasons and doing that tour in 08. The differences and similarities were pretty noticeable the whole time. I thought about it every day that I was on a book tour. Sometimes it's like, wow, it's so fun to be alone. I can eat wherever I want. I can wake up whenever I want. If I want to just like get in an Uber and go to a different place right now, I can do it. And then there were times where like a book event in Cleveland ended and it was 8:30 and suddenly I was alone in a bookstore in Cleveland and would just like eat Thai food in my hotel room alone and watch Law and Order and go to bed and wish that there were some smelly dudes around to hang out with.
I know. Yeah. Nothing better than Cleveland Thai food too,
They're really known for it there. Yeah.
Yeah. We learned that. In fact, you, I think, were the one that explained to me that the primary tour rule is never order seafood in a state that doesn't touch the ocean or a very large body of water.
It's a pretty good rule.
It is, yeah. I think it was we were in Oklahoma and you were like, we're not getting sushi. It's Oklahoma, we're not getting sushi.
Yum.
So your origin story as someone in show business and now like, a high ranking guy that tries to pay bands in cocaine, like we know all record executives do. Yeah. Because it's like, oh, we don't have any money, but we do have this really stomped on cocaine. You got your start as a drummer. You grew up in a musical household.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it that made you choose the drums over, say, the sousaphone or...
All right, the oboe, any of the things that kids choose. I mean...
Because your dad was a vibraphonist, and even though he wasn't in your life, his presence was pretty large, right?
Sure, and a percussionist, I mean, it's not the same instrument, but it's a percussion instrument, and I never knew him, but I knew who he was, and he was famous when I was a kid. And my uncle, my mother's a dancer, and her brother, my uncle, who I'm very close with still, is a saxophone player. He's really the person that got me into drums, I think. And the stories go and the pictures will demonstrate that I spent a lot of time just like playing pots and pans, like lots of kids do as a kid. And my uncle saw that and bought me a drum set when I was 2.5 years old, which most uncles or parents don't do. So that was the difference. So it was a real drum set. And I think I remember it. I'm also aware that, people sort of make up memories associated with stories and visions and things. But I think I remember it being 2.5 and my uncle carrying each drum in one by one to our apartment in Cambridge, where we lived at the time, Massachusetts, and what it sounded like and how big they were. It wasn't a kid's set. It was like a Ludwig 4-piece drum set, full size, sort of this orange and silver splotch set that I sold at some point in high school, probably for like $50, and really wish I hadn't. But But yeah, I mean, I got drums and never took lessons, just always played along to records, played a ton. Mom was super supportive, so we never cared about the neighbors. And this is like in the 70s. Everyone was hippies. It was all good. It was totally fine. It was really great.
Well, and you guys were, I mean, you grew up partly just living in squats, right? Or you guys would take over a building and like rig a wire for the electricity to the neighboring building?
I mean, almost, yeah. I mean, my mom and I lived in like, you know, more like sort of subsidized family housing in Amherst and Cambridge. But my uncle in his 20s really lived in like the true off the grid downtown New York and what's now Tribeca, but then was not. And just like this, yeah, I mean, you could call it a squat. I mean, they legally rented it and it was $500 for the entire building. It was 4 or 5 stories. I spent lots of time here as a kid. All music all the time. That's all they did. They had electricity. They didn't have heat. They didn't have air conditioning. And this is at a time when New York was a lot colder. The joke that my uncle still makes is that, and it's not a joke, if you put a glass of water out next to the bed at night, it would freeze. And so if you didn't want it to freeze, you should put it in the fridge and that would keep it room temperature. It's like the olden days, but it's true. And some of my best memories are in this freezing house playing drums. It's a really special place.
I had a house like that in Spokane where we came downstairs at one point. You know, it was 400 degrees below zero outside. And there was a pitcher of water that, it was a party house, you know, a pitcher of water that somebody had thrown an apple in, which already gives you a sense of where I was living. And the whole thing was frozen solid, like a pitcher of water, apple in the center. And that was when we decided, like, we can't live here this week, you know?
Right.
So we went across to the house across the street that had power, that had heat. And we said, we can't be in our house. Can we stay here for the week? And yeah, they were generously said
I thought you were going to say you ran an extension cord, a big orange cable across the street. Just
well,
plugged
no,
in a couple space heaters.
It had no form of heat. There wasn't, the heat wasn't available.
Right,
and I don't even know if there were space heaters then.
They're so dangerous. They're so scary.
Well, so now you live in New York and you live in Palm Springs, which I think you're broadcasting from today.
I'm broadcasting from Palm Springs, where it's kind of cold and raining and feels a lot like Seattle right now.
Yeah.
Which is a drag.
But you came to the Northwest when you were young to go to college. Why did you move to the Northwest of all the places?
Yeah, I was in Salt Lake City, Utah before that. So my mom and I lived in New York and Amherst on the East Coast until I was about 10. And then she worked for American Express. And they moved us to Salt Lake City because the company moved a big part of the whatever the operations there. And Salt Lake was kind of a great place. And that's where I got more into drums and got to see tons of shows and buy records and everything. It was really not the cultural wasteland I assumed it would be. But a lot of kids from Salt Lake went to college in the Northwest or in California. And so I just started looking at all those like Lewis and Clark and Willamette and University of Puget Sound, where I ended up going, all these sort of liberal arts schools where my mom was pushing me, and loved UPS because it was in Tacoma. It's just outside of Seattle, but this is 1989 in Seattle. I mean, I remember going there and just feeling it, just being like, this is music. There's every single pole on the street has a flyer for some band. There's so many record stores. There's so many venues. Like, you just could not, you know this, you couldn't miss it. It was happening. And that's why I went there.
Yeah, we talk a lot. I think of all the things I thought I would talk about on podcasts, I mean, it's not like I ever thought about podcasts because they didn't exist. And even since I've been doing them, I don't think about them. But we talk a lot about Salt Lake City on this show.
Hmm.
8 years of talking more or less about Salt Lake City because Ken went to college there.
Yeah.
And also we talk about American Express a lot. So
mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I can relate to both.
So, yeah, you showed up here right about the same time I did, at a time right before the big cultural crash, when it was really happening, but Seattle was still small and shitty and dark
and cheap.
Super
that,
cheap.
That was a big key part of it that I always end up telling people, how I opened a record store there, how people played in bands. All of that relies on a city being cheap.
Tell us about that. You're... As somebody that really never, I guess,
had a job,
fledged, or what did you call me? As somebody who never like became an adult, you became an adult pretty young, right? Like you were already a business owner a lot earlier than a lot of people.
Yeah, but in such a different way. I mean, I, you know, as part of the book tour and or sort of continued stuff from that, I end up speaking at colleges occasionally, and that's always really interesting. That's, you know, it's a totally different talk. And part of what I love to talk about is how my friend and I, Jason Hughes, opened a record store in Seattle in 1997. Sonic Boom Records, it's still there. We were both 25. We were working at Easy Street, a record store in West Seattle that's still there, probably making $8 an hour. I don't know, maybe it was $7, it was something ridiculous. But both single, both living in, you know, rented houses, paying like $300 a month or whatever with roommates, like very simple, simple lives. And we decided we wanted to open a store. And so we found this spot in a Seattle neighborhood called Fremont that was $1,500 a month. It was the main floor of like a house that was sort of a retail zone space. It was nothing special. It wasn't that big. And we
seriously right on the main drag.
Right on the main, well, right off the main drag. But yeah, close to the main drag.
Oh, the original one, off the main drag.
And remember, we really did sit down with a bar napkin and we're like, okay, it's going to cost $1,500 for rent. We need to buy some stock. We need to pay ourselves very little. We figured out that it was going to cost about $5,000 a month to do it, to keep it going. Whoa. And about $30,000 to open it, most of which was just like building bins and buying records to sell or CDs. And we broke it down. We're like, okay, so how much is that per week, per month, per day? How much is it per hour? And we got to this equation where you're like, okay, it seems like we need to sell two CDs and one used CD per hour. And that was the thing that made us say like, oh, that seems like we could do that. That was the business plan. And that was like the lightning moment where we're like, that doesn't sound like that much. And it seriously worked. And that was how we planned it. And there's a lot more to it. We were lucky. I mean, that's right when Death Cab and Pedro the Lion and Modest Mouse and all the sort of this, not the big Seattle grunge bands, but like this next wave of indie rock bands were becoming a thing. And they kind of lived around our neighborhood and became kind of customers and friends. And Nick from Death Cab worked in the store. And so we really also, a huge part of it was that we became part of this community. That was really a lot. But that's what Seattle felt like at the time. It was very much that in different neighborhoods. And so it worked. But so I guess I grew up, but like, you could not do that now. You would have to go, well, you go talk to some VC people and, you know, make, have a prospectus and talk to some CEO. And
right. It would take you $250,000.
Yeah. If Nick from Death Cab was working there now, he'd want stock options or something. Right. It's all
like, right. But I mean, what you just described, the business plan that you guys came up with and wrote on a cocktail napkin, that's more thinking about your job and life than I've ever done cumulatively since I was 14 years old. So it sounds very impressive to me. Like,
well, I'm glad you think so. Thanks. I mean, I still do think of things in those terms. I mean, I hope, you know, my boss isn't listening, but like, of course we have like fancy budgets for records and everything, but so much of it is just like sort of gut and what it looks like and what it feels like and what you think seems doable. Like that's, I think, a good way to live. And that, I think that's what you've been doing, and that's why it's working, and that's why you're here in this fancy podcast.
I know I've told you this, but I'll say it again. When you joined the Long Winters, which was, you know, halfway through our or maybe even a little bit later in our long arc as an indie band, mm-hmm. You transformed the band by kind of using that sort of calculus on me. You like Jedi mind tricked me several times.
By saying
like the way you're currently doing it for only a few pennies more, you could be doing it this way. And then we wouldn't be, you know, like trying to microwave cheese tortillas in a gas station microwave, but we would actually be eating and sleeping in beds and so forth. And I was like, I don't know. That sounds pretty bourgeois. But you really did. You made touring quite a bit easier for us, and you made being in the band a lot easier just by kind of not just your calculus, but also the way you very subtly managed me in a way that no one else had ever tried.
That's
you
funny.
Know,
well, I take that as a compliment. The thing that I remember well that we still talk about was Priceline. And of course, some of this was just the time and that sort of 2005, 2006 zone. Maybe I still had a BlackBerry that might have been pre-iPhone, but like it was just getting easier to do a lot of stuff from the van or from the hotel, and Priceline was a new thing. So suddenly it was like, wow, we're in, you know, Pittsburgh on a Tuesday night. We can actually stay in the Radisson Inn for $59. Like that kind of thing was, those hacks were great at that time.
It was amazing.
And
was
not
amazing.
The shitty also, motel, you know, yeah.
Oh, God. I remember being on tour with the Decembrists, and they were like, we only stay at La Quinta Inns.
They had an endorsement.
Well, I don't know what it was, but I was like, wow, La Quinta.
They've made it.
Are you kidding me? Like, they have free coffee in the morning. What the?
A waffle station.
And I think it was the first time Death Cab, like, what I realized that they each had their own hotel room.
Well, that's pretty, I mean, that is extravagant at any level.
Instead of, like, two people to a room, I was like, okay,
all right.
Mm. What the hell is going on? Is there money to be made in rock and roll?
I had my own room on the book tour every time.
Right? Well, it's funny. It's funny that you say, like, that you don't... you know, this thing about stock options and so forth, because your wife, your lovely bride, is a financial planner. Mm-hmm. And when she first opened her shop, she first hung out her shingle. We were talking and she was like, well, you should use me as your financial advisor. And I was like, well, I don't know if I have any money, like, but if I did. And then a few years later, I reached out and I was like, so what about being my financial advisor? And she said at that point, having built her business a little, she was like, you don't really have equity in anything.
My point exactly.
Right? And I was like, well, I have equity in the long winters. And she was like, yeah, I know. But I mean, equity in anything. And yeah, so.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Still don't. I should have given you guys $5,000. Oh, but I didn't have $5,000. I was making $6 an hour.
Right.
Well, so I have known you to be a drummer who keeps meticulous time and is a rock and roll legend in the Northwest. But one thing you're not is a, at least in my experience, like a musical instrument hoarder.
Right, right.
We know a lot of people.
I know what you mean. I'm talking to one.
Yes. We are, but like our friend, our mutual friend and erstwhile Long Winters drummer, Mike Musburger, at one point, I think he had 25 drum kits.
That's too many.
Like they'd taken up the whole basement and just walls and walls of racks. And he's like, these are the Vistalites. These are the, you know, the Gretsch.
Of course.
But you've never been like that. Is that
never
right?
Never been like that. I mean, at one point I got into, this is in Seattle when I had a much bigger house and a house I could play drums in. I got to a point where I wasn't ever into collecting drum kits. I don't think I ever had more than two, but I was into collecting what they call orphan drums, which is such a sad, sad name, which is just like a single loose drum from a kit. So, you know, sometimes you see drummers playing and it's like, well, weird. He's got a, you know, a red sparkle bass drum, but like a wood coated tom and a metal snare, like none of those things match. And some, those are orphan drums, most likely, meaning like that person just really liked the way that tom sounded and he found it at a thrift shop or he, you know, somehow stumbled into this bass drum. So for a little while, I probably had 10 orphan drums, but never a crazy collection. At the most, three or four snares, which is, if anything, people collect snares. That's a thing.
But I never saw you like tour with a kit made out of orphan drums.
No, I guess not. Yeah.
And I feel like that's pretty rare.
Hmm.
Most drummers show up with a matching kit, right?
Right.
Wouldn't you
say? Yeah, definitely.
You know, you can't manage your heart health if you're missing half the info. Standard tests will check the basics, but they skip over key markers that could change everything. Right now it's National Heart Month. And I've personally been thinking more about my heart health, especially because I have high blood pressure. And what surprised me was how much I didn't know until I actually saw my lab results. That's what I like about Function. It doesn't tell you what to worry about. It shows you what's actually happening in your body. Function is designed by world-class physicians and trusted by hundreds of thousands of members. Health leaders like Dr. Mark Hyman, Dr. Andrew Huberman, and Dr. Jeremy London support it because once you understand your health, everything changes. You stop guessing, you stop being reactive, and you start making decisions based on real insights. So own your own health and start with your heart. Function gives you access to 160 plus lab tests every year, including advanced markers for heart health, for inflammation, for stress, for hormones and toxins, for only $365 a year. That's $1 a day. Learn more and join by using our link. Visit functionhealth.com/omnibus and use the gift code omnibus25 for a $25 credit towards your membership. That's functionhealth.com/omnibus. Use the gift code omnibus25 for a $25 credit toward your membership. How does a Rack-Tom escape its kit?
That's a good question. Does it get stolen? Because one of mine definitely did at one point. I can think about this particular, now I'm turning into a drum nerd, right? That I'm not supposed to
be. Let's
go. DW Tom that I bought on eBay. It's a super strange size. It was 13 by 13. Rarely do you see the same head size as the depth of the drum. Usually the depth is less than the head size. 13 by 13, so it kind of looked like a cannon. It's a very long looking drum, and it was a black tom. And I remember buying it for $231.50 on eBay, which is really cheap for like those 90s DW drums are like some of the most rock, like really great sounding drums. And I think I just bought it because it looked cool and because it was relatively cheap because people weren't that into orphan drums. So that was also part of why I was collecting them. So it was like, well, that drum's going to sound great. I don't care what it looks like. So I had some things like that, but yeah, I don't think they ever, I had two great drum sets. So I was probably a little too vain to be like, well, I'm going to put this weird cannon looking thing over there with my silver sparkle drum set and have people ask me about it. I think, and some people might want to do that, but I think I was the opposite. I wanted to, you know, you want to have the smooth, tight kit.
Well, is that how a drum gets away? Like somebody decides they're not going to use the second rack tom or something, like they pare their kit down and. Yeah. And a drum kind of just skates off?
I think so. It's so weird. I wish I actually knew. Maybe they actually leave on their own. Maybe they're not orphaned. Maybe they're runaways.
Runaways.
I mean, but I'm sure I think there's theft involved. I mean, we've all left our stuff in practice places over the years. And I've definitely lost. I'm positive cymbals have gone missing the same way, which is a similar thing. They're easy to take. They're valuable. They're small. I think drums get stolen. I do think people, yeah, if you have like a five piece with two toms that, you know, hasn't been that cool for a long time, if you can get $100 for one of those toms or $200, why wouldn't you sell that to someone like me? So I think that's part of it. And you do see it a lot more in studios where, of course, people will put together whatever because they don't care what it looks like. So totally mismatched, weird looking kits.
Drummers have always astonished me as having played with the dozen or more because they keep dying.
It's Final Tap reference.
but it's so much more work to be a drummer than really any other job.
Thank you.
Do you feel seen?
It really is. It's such a pain in the ass.
Beep.
It's not like the bass player is running over like, hey, can I help you break those down? You're just like alone. Everyone's off partying and you're like taking down a cymbal stand and, you know, unscrewing some felt or whatever. It's the worst.
Well, you know, Michael Schilling, when he was the drummer of the Western State Hurricanes, and we toured with him and the Long Winters for a couple of years, and he was adamant about not putting his drums in a case of any kind. He didn't even really put them in bags. He just carried them out under his arm and like threw him in the back of the van. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen.
I mean, I get it from a time perspective and a space perspective, it makes sense.
But drummers would actually come out watching us load out and be like, what madness is this?
Right.
And his drums all got delaminated over time just because it's just like getting really rough around.
But the heads didn't break? I mean, that's what you'd worry about.
I don't know. That's the other thing. He took pride in not tuning his drums.
Wow.
Because it wasn't very like rock.
And he ended up leaving the band, huh?
Yeah, but only because he left the band. I would have kept him. I didn't know the difference.
That's funny. I saw him play in many bands and his drums always sounded great. I mean, the fancy thing that you see sometimes, this is always, I'm always so jealous of this, is like, you know, big arena shows, you see the drums never get broken down. They're bolted down to their own riser, and the forklift comes and lifts up the riser and just puts it straight in the truck.
Can you imagine?
I mean, I would want to just stay on it. I wouldn't even leave.
Covered with like a velvet blanket.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God.
Somebody shining the cymbals.
Well, you said earlier that, that even drummers that are austere do collect snares, or if you're going to collect anything, it would be a snare.
Mm-hmm.
And my first real exposure to that was when Matt Chamberlain played on Commander Thinks Aloud.
Mm.
And he showed up to the studio and he had this snare that he, that was called the Black Eagle or a Black Thunderbird.
Black Beauty?
It was a Black Beauty.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. It's a very common snare.
Yeah, but it was very old. It was like visibly very old.
Right.
And I said, I like your old drum. And I think he either, it's not his way to say something like this. It might have been Tucker, Tucker Martin, who was recording the record. But I think he said, you have no idea what that snare is and what it, you know, like the fact that
snare
is
going to make you $1 million, buddy.
The fact that that snare is even in this room is so implausible.
Don't even look at it.
That you could afford to be in a room with that snare.
Right.
And that was the dawn of thinking like, oh, there's like a 59 Les Paul of snare.
Totally. Right. And the Black Beauty is like, it's a Ludwig brand. They make the Black Beauty snare. And I think they've been making them, whatever, this whole time. I don't know if it's like cars, if drum companies release a new drum every year, but the Black Beauty is like a known thing. I most of the time in the long winters, I played a Black Beauty, but not like a, whatever, like a 90s one, not a 59 Les Paul one, but it sounded great.
Yeah. He said this one was from the 20s and it looked like it had been etched. There were like birds in it that had been etched in by probably some Italian immigrant.
Right, right.
Who, you know, like it was just, it was
somebody,
it was
important.
Truly a thing of beauty.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
Hence the name.
Well, at the time, Italian immigrants weren't really considered that important.
Oh, right. That was a time when there's kind of like cheap labor doing incredible work for not very much money in America. Yeah.
That's right. People that knew how to, you know, who could have rebuilt the Roman Colosseum, but they were living in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
All that beautiful detail, downtown Manhattan.
So, when you were collecting snares, walk me through your snare collection.
Okay.
At its peak, the height.
At its peak, the Black Beauty was my main drum, which is a 6.5 inch, which is, I would say, there are maybe two standard snare sizes. Drummers, feel free to, you know, post in the comments and disagree, but either the 5x14 or the 6.5x14. Those are the standard sizes. The 5 being a bit more shallow, the 6.5 being deeper and maybe more associated with rock music, but doesn't have to be. And there are other sizes.
And that changes their tone, like the thicker one is deeper?
Yeah, the thicker or the deeper the drum would tend to have more full body, more low end, people would say. And they get deeper and they get shallower. There's piccolo snares that have that little 311 sound, that little ting, 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 pop. Yeah, that's a thing. But I would have had the Black Beauty, which I probably got off of eBay when I was buying Orphans, a drum by a guy named Alfonso Adinolfi, who I know you've met, who's a drum maker in Washington State, who makes incredible only wood drums. I don't think he really messes with metal, and snares can be made of all kinds of material, whereas all the rest of the drums are typically wood. Snares can be different materials. So I had an Adinolfi, I think maybe it was called Boom Theory at the time, but maybe it was Adinolfi, his name, a Silver Sparkle 6.5x14 from him. Also a one of one drum that's actually here in this house in Palm Springs that he called a Fabergé snare that had this beautiful, like sort of diamond, almost argyle pattern that looked like a Fabergé egg on it. And that was a really great sounding drum. Wow. So now we're at 3. And I think that was it until, and this is some deep snare stuff here, I was in line at the post office because that's what you used to have to do if you wanted to mail something. You would go to this place in Wallingford. You probably know the one on Wallingford Ave, right? Or yeah, 50th.
I do.
And ran into Craig Keplinger, who is a very famous drum tech and drum maker. He was, I think, is or was Pearl Jam's drum tech for the longest time. Made some really weird, crazy stainless steel cymbals that were like kind of noisy sounding things, and made the Keplinger snare drum, which was a very famous, at least in Seattle. Like, this is one guy. This wasn't a factory. He didn't have like a big company, but he was making these bespoke snare drums, and they were made out of stainless steel. And I'd seen them. You couldn't really get them in stores. He made them, you know, Matt Cameron famously, I think the Black Hole Sun snare drum is that. It's this real, like, specific, incredible, powerful sound. And he rented it out, and I'd heard about it, and I think I'd seen one before, and I just saw it. I didn't know him very well, but he used to come in the store. He was a nice guy, and I saw him in line at the post office, was talking to him, and I was like, hey, how can I get one of those Keplinger snare drums? And he was like, you know, Dave Matthews Band just rented one for a long time, and I did really well on it. Do you want to just buy that one? And I don't remember how much it was, and he probably wouldn't want me to say that, but it was not that much. And I went with him that afternoon and went to the cash machine, because that was also a thing you did, and bought that snare drum. And this thing was, it's an 8x14. It is extremely heavy. It's made out of metal. Most of the long lost Long Winters album that recorded in the summer of 2008 uses that drum. And that drum was really hard to use live. It was piercing and it had all this crazy ring and it was too loud, but it really recorded well. And so I think that's what we used for almost that entire recording.
And it's made out of stainless steel. And what are other metal snare drums made of, if not stainless steel?
I'm sure there's like cheap metal. If you just buy like, you know, some starter kit, you get just like the sort of silver chrome. I don't even know what kind of metal that is, but the sort of the crown jewel is the bell brass snare drum made by Tama, which is, some brass is obviously, I think, a fancy high-end expensive metal compared to the others.
Oh, right. Brass. Mm-hmm. Of course.
And I think also kind of a musical metal, right? I mean, that's, I don't know that much about woodwinds, but like, aren't saxophones and trombones and those things made out of brass?
Also made of brass. Literally, if you put a bunch of those horns together in a room, it's called the brass section.
Of course. Right. Right.
Right. That's the part of the band, like the brass.
But then it's not called the cymbals sometimes made of brass, because that's definitely like some drummer slang, like, oh man, what kind of brass you play?
Yeah, I think they are. That's why they're gold colored instead of silver colored.
Right, right.
Right. If a cymbal was made of stainless steel, it would probably sound bad.
Right. And they would say, what kind of steel are you playing?
Clank, clank. Right.
Yeah, so brass.
Well, you know, when I first started making records, it was at a time in the late 90s when there was a lot of strong opinion about drum sounds, right? We had come out of this era of the very reverby drum sound, the gated snare, the dreaded gated snare.
Right, the 80s,
The 80s, mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were into this world where, in indie rock in particular, I spent so many hours sitting in bars while people talked past me, about their strong opinions about drum sounds.
Hmm.
And I never understood any of it. It was all gibberish to me, because listening to records like, and I, even if I zoomed in and thought hard about what I was hearing, I could certainly hear the difference between snare drums.
Right.
But what I couldn't do was formulate a strong opinion about them. Because this is the sound of that snare in this. And I obviously I can form opinions about guitar tone, but I didn't know why this style of music would want a snare that sounded thus, or it just seemed like, well, it's an arbitrary decision. You like the sound of this drum, and then that's the sound of the record. But is it true that, I mean, you would pick a snare and say, this is a snare that reflects the band more than the band is going to become whatever I choose with this snare.
Right. I'm going to build a band around the snare drum. That's usually how I did it. actually kind of amazing. But yeah, of course. I think as, you know, as like a conscious and kind drummer, you want to, just like with any instrument, you want to walk in and have the tool for the job, right? If you're recording a country album, maybe you don't want to walk in with your huge Keplinger snare drum. You want to have something that's made out of wood and that'll sound good if you play brushes on it or whatever. So there is a little bit of that. There's also the idea that the snare drum is a pretty malleable instrument. Like, no matter what the drum, you can make it really loose, you can make it really tight, you can make it somewhere in between. You can put tape all over it and have it be the super dead thud, or you can have it be really open and ring a lot. So there's a lot of room to make it sound different. And even the way you hit it, if you hit it just on the head with the tip of the stick, you'll get one sound. Whereas if you hit the rim at the same time, which I believe is called a rim shot, you get a much more sort of cracking sound. So it's not just the drum, it's all the stuff you do to it and how you play it. But the drum itself, I think, in the end, is the thing that's going to define the sound.
And when you sit down behind a really nice snare, the experience is better as a player. Like, you're like, oh man, this
snare. I feel
like snare.
I'm being gaslit a little bit here, right? Yeah, man, when I sit down behind a nice snare.
There's nothing like that feeling.
I mean, it's weird because, like, how I'm trying to, I don't play drums that much anymore, but like, you sat down at a drum kit, you obviously have some preconceived notion of what it is, just as if you picked up, wow, that's a 59 Les Paul. You expect it to feel and sound great. You see a drum set that looks nice, so you already have an idea. It's supposed to sound good, right? Even whatever, like a good meal. You're at a fancy restaurant, something comes out looking good, you assume it's going to be good. But I wonder if you took all that away and you just like blindly went in and hit a drum, if it would be as easy to tell if it was good or not. It's such a weird thing. And they make this joke a lot, but it's sort of true. I mean, if you hit drums hard enough, they tend to just sound pretty good. And maybe that was Schilling's thing. Like, I don't mean go crazy on them. I just mean, like, if a drum's out of tune or a crappy drum and you give it kind of a ding, you get the like warbly crappy sound. But if you hit it for real, you'll get a pretty good sound, especially if you're recording it, because you can just get the sound of the drum head itself, not all the air surrounding it and all the stuff after. So it's, I mean, I also don't know what I'm talking about. I've never recorded drums. I just played them.
Well, that's the thing about Michael Schilling. As you say, he is he communicated his rage right into his drum kit. He hit those things so hard. Right. And I think that must be why they sounded amazing. Like, he was just, even if he hit a grace note and the drum did start to ring, he would follow it immediately with such a hit that any ringing the drum thought it was going to do was over and done.
Right.
Well, so when you go to watch, you've seen probably of everybody I know more live shows as a record store owner, as a musician yourself, and then for now a decade and a half. Closing on 2 decades.
17 years. Yeah.
Yeah. A label guy who is going to shows, because back in the 90s, we went to 5 shows a week, whether we wanted to or not, because there was nothing else to do in
Seattle.
Which meant
15 bands a week. Yeah.
15 bands a week. Right. And none of us could even afford to go to the movies. So it was like, well, we can all go to shows.
Right.
Because either they're $5 or, right, you know, at a certain point, you walk in and for free. But then you became somebody who was seeing bands across all levels, from indie bands in small clubs in New York City to some of your artists were major touring acts, and you were seeing them in really big places.
Madison Square Garden.
Right. How often would you be at a show watching a band and think, God, this drum sound sucks? this drum kit sucks.
I can't think of a time. I mean, does that even happen live? I mean, I think all drums sound good once you throw a bunch of guitars and throw mics on them and put them in a big room or even a small room. I think it's just fine. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever had that feeling. I mean, certainly like up close, I've hit a drum, but that's different than seeing a show with a full band. I don't think that's ever happened.
Right. It's always about the player, and you're never like, oh, that Tom is, you used to say during sound check, You know, the sound man is like, okay, hit the sound. Doom, 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 yeah. doom. And you'd hit it five times, and then you'd go, that's more times than I'm going to hit this drum in the entire set.
There's a video that I still have of from us in probably 2006 when we opened, the Long Winters opened for Keen in Europe, and it's huge arenas of Europe. And I think this is like in Switzerland or in Sweden or somewhere, some huge arena. It's empty. We're sound checking, and it's just me checking the tom within this cavernous, empty arena. And it's, doom. I'm not sure. What, yeah, one of us had the phone, and it's just a circle of the entire empty arena, and just me going, doom, doom, doom. For like a minute. It's so boring.
The best. I think that's why I don't have any hearing in my right ear is all exactly. The whack, whack, whack.
Yes.
But yeah, there are so many instances where you see a band and you're like, that guitar sound sucks. Like this band would be so much better if
that's
that
true.
Guitar tone wasn't so lame.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been at a show and thought, this drummer's great, but
the tone,
wrong kit, bro.
Maybe that's because just no one pays attention to drummers in actuality.
It could be.
Unless they had a piccolo snare, but that never happens.
Ping, ping, pop, pop. But you're here today to tell us about a snare that you mentioned a minute or two ago.
Yeah, the Tama Bell Brass.
Yeah, you did a good job of trying to get that in there.
You'll take it out.
It was nice. Well, no, it's good because there is a subset of futurelings that like to timestamp the first time the title of the episode gets mentioned.
Planting seed.
And so you did it early enough that this will be like, oh, yeah, that's cool. They got to it at the 35-minute mark.
Oh, nice.
But here we are at the 50-minute mark.
Wow.
Before we really get to it. I know, right? I'm very curious about this because, as you say, I am a musical instrument, not just collector, but hoarder, but not nearly as bad as some of the musicians we know. Kurt Block has 400 guitars and
really,
it's just crazy.
That's
along
many.
With everything else, you know, he's got he's
pedals.
Vintage, every stair pedals.
Right.
But snares, they are beautiful, items, right? Mm-hmm. They're beautiful, like, things. And I don't have any, but I don't have any snares here. I guess I have one or two. But I remember when I was in that relationship with that gal, down in Venice, we were in some vintage store and found a snare. And it was such a beautiful thing that we bought it just to display in her living room.
Oh, wow.
As just like a snare on the credenza.
Just a snare on a credenza.
Just a snare on the credenza. And after it was there for a while and after it, you know, it had become an established part of her decor, I was like, this is brilliant.
Mm.
Like just having a snare treated as a work of sculpture.
You would never like make nachos in it or bake something.
She was too classy to make nachos
just for show.
It was just for show. But it was. I thought clever, and I think it was meant as a reference to the fact that her boyfriend was a musician.
Ah,
that now she had kind of, either earned the right or it was, you know, like, oh yeah, this is a snare because, you know, like.
Right.
Do you know who my boyfriend is? Which I'm sure she never said to the other tech lawyers that she was having lunch with. But but so I could see the logic of collecting beautiful snares, but you're talking about a snare. Well, why don't you tell us about the Tama Brass Bell?
The Tama Bell Brass snare is a snare with a particular sound. And I think the interesting thing about the snare is that it's sort of been proven, if that's possible. It's famously the snare drum that you hear on Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit from 1991. And it's interesting because, of course, I'm a drummer, but to me, Nirvana is a guitar band completely. It's all about Kurt's guitar and Kurt's voice. Dave Grohl is an incredible drummer. Chris is an incredible bass player. But to me, Nirvana is guitars. But when I think of that song, and I think when a lot of people think about that song, they think about that first fill, the which is just like arguably the most famous snare drum intro in the history of rock music. Maybe there's a few, I don't know, but it's definitely up there. And apparently that recording is of not just the Tama Bell Brass snare, but a Tama Bell Brass snare, a specific one that is owned by the drum doctor in Los Angeles, California, Glendale, California, to be exact. It's a company who rents out drums and I think other gear, but he's called the drum doctor, so mostly drums, and has hundreds of snares, hundreds of kits, tons of things. And that snare is apparently on that song. It's on Metallica Enter Sandman, which doesn't have the same kind of fill, but when I think about that song, I can certainly hear that snare. I think it's on a Rage Against the Machine album, the first album, and on the Offspring Smash. And when I think of all these are all like, you know, early 90s alt radio, rock radio, like all very like aggressive cutting guitar songs, but with a snare that cut through those guitars. And so there's something about this, not only the model of drum, but that specific drum that this dude owns that had something to do with those songs. And I mean, is it funny to think, we're talking about, you know, you would never go to a show and say, oh, weird, that drum kit doesn't sound good. So is it possible to think that this particular drum had the ability to be part of the success of those songs or albums? It seems strange to me, but it's a very common element.
Because they were all produced by different producers. So there's no common thread of like, oh, it's just
this drum. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Or it's like, and I'm sure they were all mic'd with a SM57 on the top and
$100 mic. Exactly. Right.
And they all went through an 1176 with all the buttons pushed in or whatever it is that you guys do. I don't know what it would. Do you know the signal chain for that's the most common way to record a snare drum?
I definitely do not, but I'm sure you're right. It's like it's a 57 and maybe one other mic on the top of the bottom.
Into a distressor or something.
Yeah. Right. But I think it's usually pretty simple.
So it does suggest either that it's the drum or that the mythology of that particular drum meant that everybody wanted it. But how would that drum have that mythology if all these records were being made at the same time?
Right. I mean, same period, but different drummer, obviously, different band, different music, different songwriters, probably different studios, maybe somewhere in the same studios, but not all the same studio, but the same drum.
And Dave Grohl being widely considered as one of the best hard rock drummers, Lars Ulrich being considered one of the worst hard rock drummers,
right,
and yet both using the same snare to great effect.
It's got to be the snare.
It's got to be the snare. Well, so you mentioned Adinolfi, and I have met him a few times, and he's a real nutter butter. And then, like every drum, it's not true of all drummers, but every drum tech or drum focused like technical person is, in my experience, a total nutter butter, right? Like they're all very weird. It's a weird world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Have you met the drum doctor?
I have not met the drum doctor. I did give him a call, however. And we had a nice conversation. It wasn't that long. He didn't seem thrilled to be hearing from me, but because I wasn't calling to buy or rent anything, but it's a very nice guy. His name's Ross. And we were talking about the Tama Bell Brass snare. He told me that he has, I think, four more of them, but the one is the one. So they're just specifically 1980 model, by the way. So he has five in total, four that all sound great, but one that is the one. It's called the Terminator. And I'm going to read something from their website because it's pretty good. It says, I coined the nickname the Terminator because it crushed the competition when we auditioned snares for projects and songs. So it obviously has a sound. And the funny thing was, I said, do you still rent the Terminator? And he said, yes, I do. And I said, how much is it to rent the Terminator? And he said, well, that's interesting, which is always an interesting way to answer a question. He said, It's $100.
Whoa.
And that's what I said. And he said, but you need to pay me to stick around.
Oh.
And he didn't tell me how much that cost, but I had heard rumors that when you rent this drum, he comes, he will not leave the drum ever during the session. You pay the drum doctor and you pay for the drum. And when the session's done, he takes the drum with him and he leaves. When it's lunchtime, I assume he stays if the drum's staying. It's very interesting business.
And he gets paid $1,000 an hour.
Yeah, he didn't tell me how much, but probably that's probably where the money is, less than the rental, the $100 a day rental.
So if I was some kind of rich asshole, which I'm neither thing.
No.
But if I were, and I was in Los Angeles, and I was having a party as part of a film festival, I could rent the drum for $100 and get not only the drum, but then pay the literal drum doctor to come stand in the middle of the room with the drum on a table with a light shining on it. And then basically ask/force the drum doctor to stand there and talk about the drum that made all these records.
I don't know if he would do that. You might need to strike a separate deal, but you could rent the drum and have him present.
That seems like...
Yeah.
Why,
it feels like a pretty good exhibit, right? I would actually like to, yeah.
If you showed up at a party and you were like, oh, God, another entertainment business party. And then there was the drum doctor and he had Bernard Purdy's, like, you done it. You done hired the hitmaker
flags. And he's probably got incredible stories, right? And from a specific weird angle, too. Yeah.
Well, because literally he's been standing there in the studio when all these, or, you know, at least more recently, he's watched all these records get made.
Yeah, yeah.
Every group has someone who insists on doing things the hard way. Am I right? I'm often that person. But you know, it's the person that is still paying for a subscription that they don't use, forgot they probably had. It's the one refusing to update their phone because it still works. Hello, me. And now, that one who's somehow still overpaying for wireless in 2026. But Mint Mobile is here to help with that last one. So stop paying too much for wireless just because that's how it's always been. Mint Mobile exists purely to fix that. Same coverage, same speed, just without the inflated price tag. The premium wireless you expect, unlimited talk, text, and data, but at a fraction of what others would charge. And for a limited time, get 50% off 3, 6, or 12-month plans of unlimited premium wireless. You bring your own phone number, you activate with an eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. No long-term contracts and no hassle. With a 7-day money-back guarantee and customer satisfaction ratings in the mid-90s, Mint makes it easy to try it and see why people don't go back. This is especially exciting to me because my teenage daughter, unbeknownst to her, is about to get her first cell phone in March for her birthday. And please don't tell her if you're listening to the show and for some reason, some weird reason, you have contact with my daughter, which you should not. Don't tell her. She's going to get a phone. And Mint Mobile is going to keep me from paying that premium price for what is going to be a premium service. So are you ready to stop paying more than you have to? New customers can make the switch today, and for a limited time, get unlimited premium wireless for just $15 a month. Switch now at mintmobile.com/omnibus. That's mintmobile.com/omnibus. An upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan required. That's a $15 a month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Over 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. Additional terms apply. See mintmobile.com for details.
And the one thing that I thought was interesting, I had a funny afterthought when I was thinking about those records, the Offspring Smash is sort of often touted as at the time, whatever, early 90s, 94 maybe. That's like the big one with Come Out and Play and Self Esteem and all those tunes. And it was on Epitaph, an indie label. And at the time, they weren't a huge band going in, and that blew up. Sold millions of copies. It was, you know, at the time, maybe the biggest independent record in history, or certainly one of it. It was really, really a big deal. But at least the sort of the story and the lore around it was like, oh yeah, we had no idea, you know, that these guys just made a punk record and it got huge and everything. But now that we know they hired the drum doctor and they used that snare, does that story still hold up? That they were just making a punk record, but they wanted to use the Teen Spirit snare and the Metallica snare? I think they I think they were making a hit.
Well, sure. That whole, we're just a humble little nothing, you know, just trying to make a little humble thing. Like, oh, that's the oldest canard in the book, isn't it?
Yeah. Drum Doctor debunked it.
You know, the Offspring, the success of the Offspring is the reason, because they ended up going from Epitaph to
Columbia.
Columbia. And the reason that Harvey Danger, I don't know if you know this story, did not sign to Columbia when Columbia offered to meet London Records' whole record contract plus $1 million signing bonus was that the guys in Harvey Danger thought the Offspring were uncool and they didn't want to be on the same label. And instead they wanted to be on London Records because London Records had, I don't know, Tones on Taylor. Who was on London Records in that Harvey Danger would have cared about?
All right. Portishead, the Mises.
Yeah. Portishead.
Right. Joe Mies. That's an interesting, I mean, that seems in retrospect like a poor decision, but you got to do what you got to do.
That's right. I joined the band after that decision was made, right, as you know, couple of years later. And it was still a thing at that point in time that there was a lot other people had a lot to say about that decision. Nobody in the band ever referred to it, but right, John Goodmanson sure had a lot to say about it.
Really? I wonder if John Goodmanson's ever rented anything from the Drum Doctor. I bet he has.
Oh my God, that's exactly the kind of question we should ask John Goodmanson right now. Mm-hmm. He and I were just texting.
Is he on the line?
He is not currently on the line, but you know, he does sometimes respond.
He's ready. He's waiting for your call.
I should have, if I had known.
Surprise.
If I had known. Hey, John, did you ever rent a drum from the drum?
I bet he's rented the Terminator. I bet the Terminator is on, trying to think, what, like Sleater-Kinney record? Probably not.
Do you remember when we recorded that that cover of a, what was it? We did like
Pet Name by They Might Be Giants.
No, we were down in Los Angeles and we needed to record a Velvet Underground cover.
Oh, yeah.
For some kind of thing.
It wasn't like someone's house. And it was like a home studio, like home vibe.
Yeah, we just raced in. But Goodmanson, for whatever reason, was in LA and showed up at the session.
Oh, I don't remember that. How weird. I do remember that session. Yeah. I don't remember the name of the song, but I can hear it.
I think it was...
gonna be good. That one.
Yeah, right. That one. And Goodmanson just showed up and sat on a stool. And watched this record get made. And somehow I thought it was going to make us like $50,000 because it was going to get used in the Gilmore Girls.
Oh, wow.
Or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then
But they were like, the snare sound doesn't really...
Yeah, they wrote and said, oh, we're going to go in a different direction. Yeah.
We got someone who means the Terminator over here, so we're going to pop that in the old Rory Gilmore scene.
So did you call the Drum Doctor specifically in order to get this information about this episode, or were you trying to rent the drum?
I did. I wanted to come prepared. I did not want to show up here not knowing anything about the Drum Doctor.
What do you think? What does the Drum Doctor think it is about this snare that makes it different from a snare that was made an hour before or an hour later on the same assembly line? Is it just the ghost in the machine?
I think it probably is, right? I mean, I did not ask that question, but that's how guitars are. That's how everything is, right? You get the one and it's just better than the others. It has a specific quality and people recognize it, or they just grow to believe it. But either way, there's this one, and then there's the other four. But I would imagine Tama made what, hundreds? How, like more than five of these. And they've recently, they've reissued it. So there's a reissue that's available with the Tama Bell Brass Snare as a new drum, list for $3,999, $4,000, which is expensive for a new snare drum. That's a lot. And I don't know how much his is. The Drum Doctor also started making a drum that's modeled after it called the T2, the Terminator 2, that is currently on back order. There's a waiting list. And I don't, they haven't made very many.
Right. This is the where it becomes a mythological creature, and literally every one of those he sells will be to someone who will never use it on a,
It's on credenza somewhere.
Yeah. That, or it gets used on some like rich guy's vanity project record, and
yeah. Of course.
Meanwhile, most records are being made on a just a drum kit that they
Or just a Guitar laptop. Center
or whatever.
Just using the ST or whatever.
As a label guy who's also a musician, have you ever been called into some kind of session, or have you ever attended a session where you were consulted as a in a drum tech capacity?
I don't think so. No, I have not. I did perform hand claps on a record and then get told that my hand claps did not make the cut. And that was disappointing.
Oh.
That would have been a sick credit to have.
I know, right? Oh, no, yeah. We don't know who the band was. Can you tell us who the band was?
I can't reveal that information because, you know, what if,
that's right.
What if they find out and they get mad?
Right, or what if they reissue it, remix it, and they're what this bit is missing?
That's turned into the bit, or they sell those claps to somebody and they get huge.
I have definitely recorded harmony vocals on a track or two where it didn't make the final mix. And I was like, we listened to it at the time, it sounded amazing, and they're like, yeah, we just went a different direction.
What a classic response. Okay. I remember that the trick, it's not the same thing, but the trick that that you pulled on me that I loved was with those Long Winters tracks that never got done. But I think I recorded some drums thinking you guys were playing something, but the trick was you wanted me to play a certain way and I wasn't doing it, but I would do it to whatever riff you were playing. So we recorded it. And then you use those drums for something else, and it sounded the way that you wanted it to because my brain was in the right space. That was a pretty great trick.
I remember that trick. Yeah, we did. We were, I don't know. I faked you out. And then when we flew, I put them over the part where the accent was in a different place.
Right.
And it just, but it sounded incredible. It was such a trip. Well, we did that a couple of times. You know, Michael Schilling played on Cinnamon and he didn't understand that the song was in 6/8.
Oh, whoa.
And because of the way I was playing it, you know, that kind of quality where it's like, I don't know what the hell, where his one is. And he started playing 4/4.
You're like, what the hell is this?
Well, no, I'm standing out there and Walla was on the mic like, all right. No, you're doing it wrong. And I was like, shut up. Oh. Let him cook. And so we played it and I just kept playing 3/4 and he was playing 4/4. And that's the whole sound of Cinnamon, the whole polyrhythm of it.
He
only realized he was doing it wrong later.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so weird. I mean, I only know that song the way it sounds, so I can't imagine what it would have been like coming to it. But it does. It's. I remember auditioning for the Long Winters. That was one of the songs that I played. It was like 3/4, and that was by far the one I was the most nervous because I was just like, this song feels weird.
Yeah, it does. Although, arguably, until later on, until you started drumming in the band, it was arguably the biggest. Our biggest single or whatever. It's a strange sounding rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a fun thing I think to do to drummers is to really beep with their heads because they're easy to lure away from the rest of the tribe and
just grab a slice of pizza like a follow this.
Here you go. Come on. So do you think now knowing that the amazing Terminator drum is available, what seems like kind of amazingly still available and not in a museum somewhere.
Right, right.
Would you say to a band, "Hey, let's get this drum in there," either for the sound, either it matches what you're doing, or just to give your drummer like that feeling that they have this edge?
Yeah, I would. I love the idea. And I mean, especially, I think more the sort of confidence thing, the like, I rented this drum has history. It's the same, whatever. It's, why do people record at Electric Lady? Sure, it's an incredible studio. There are a lot of incredible studios, but the stories and the mythology, and I think that can bring something to music, whether or not it's an actual thing. If you think it's bringing something, it can bring it. And I think drummers don't get too much of that. I mean, guitars obviously have stories and people have owned guitars, and drums, I feel like, are less like that. So the idea that there's this legendary drum that's on all these incredible records and you can get it for $100 plus a dude, why not?
I mean, it's true. Every time you go into a recording studio, the first thing they tell you is what got recorded through this board.
Yeah. Right, of course. Right,
this mixing board, mm-hmm. you know, this is the one I recorded that Mount Desolation record in London, and that board had apparently, through those channels, had been recorded these amazing, you know, like albums of UK rock lore.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, sitting there at the console, I was, you know, I was like, what? No way. George Michael touched this very fader with his...
You felt it.
I did. Elton John was... And they were like, he wasn't in this room. The board used to be across town in a different better studio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here it is
and we've
now.
Totally refurbished it. Different wires, different everything.
yeah. Right. It's the... Yeah, we replaced all the wood. But have you ever had the experience of being in a play in a situation as a drummer where you were, there was some kind of magic or mythology about the space or the thing? Cause there's all this in music business. Like, this is the mic.
Right. That, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that so-and-so clapped their hands into. Have you ever had that experience where it actually got into your head?
I don't think so. As a drummer, and when I was in the Lemons, we made a record at Bad Animals, which was like a fancy studio in Seattle that Hart built. And that's where Soundgarden and everyone recorded. In fact, when we were there, we were in Studio A, which you'd think would be the best, but Studio X was the best. And that's where Alice in Chains was recording down the hall. But that was a new studio, so there wasn't tons of like history behind it. We also recorded at Ardent in Memphis, tons of history there. And that's like everyone from Led Zeppelin to like, I mean, I think like Motown records, like all kinds of stuff. But that also just felt like a really cool modern studio with super nice stuff. Like it didn't feel, I couldn't feel it. So I don't think I've ever been in that position, nor have I ever had a drum that's like, this was John Bonham's, you know, hi-hat or whatever, which would be pretty fun.
Didn't we go to Ardent together, but not record there? Didn't we just go and walk around?
We may
around
have gone,
it?
Yeah, Memphis. I'm sure we're in Memphis, yeah.
Well, so do you have just kind of as the final question about your drums, do you have a drum of the ones that you have that is your magic drum? The one that you feel like is what you would reach for if I said, hey, Nabil, we're playing the Letterman show.
Right.
I guess there is no Letterman show. And, you know, and I would have to call Musburger and say, oh, we're using Nabil on this one. Sorry, buddy.
Yeah.
But if that happened, is there a drum that you would say like, this is my magic drum?
I would take the Black Beauty. I've still got it. It's here down the hall in the walk-in closet in Palm Springs, which is set up right now. It's the orange Sparkle Gretsch kit that I played in the Long Winters. That kit with the same Black Beauty is in this house right now. And that's still my favorite drum. I still have the Keplinger. That actually lives with my friend Eric Slick, who's a drummer in Nashville who plays in Dr. Dog and is like a big studio guy. And that's there because he uses it and he records with it. And so that's where a drum like that belongs, because it's a really cool, unique drum. And so I'm glad that someone's actually playing it and it's not on a credenza. But the drum that I've had this drum for 20 something years and I just love it and it sounds good with everything. So it's the Black Beauty.
Tell us briefly, you have this place in Palm Springs that I imagine A, has neighbors that don't want to hear you play, and B, you don't have any reason to get behind the kit. So what's going on with this orange Sparkle Gretsch that's set up in a in a room.
It's funny. It was in Seattle, where I moved from Seattle in 2008 to New York, but the drums remained there. A band called Stornoway on 4AD, when I worked for 4AD, somehow was like doing a tour from Seattle to LA, and our friend Jonah put together their backline and did the tour with them. And so my drums became part of that backline. They ended up in LA, lived at the Beggar's office in LA because they're drums, until someone from that office is like, hey, you gotta get these drums out of here. They're taking up space. And so they moved. My friend Craig Wedren from the band Shudder to Think has an incredible studio not too far from there in Hollywood. And so they moved to Craig's place for a long time. They were there for probably a decade. And I would visit them once in a while, see Craig, look at the drums. And when we got this place 3 years ago, I think finally maybe 2 years ago, I kept joking about wanting to get those drums from LA and bringing them here. And my wife, as a birthday or holiday gift, soundproofed the closet and said, go get the drums. And I drove to LA and got them, and they're here. So I don't play them that much. She probably plays them more than I do. But they're there and they're set up, and neighbors don't really care. It's a funny thing. I mean, I'm not playing late at night. There's a lot of people who are not here year round, so it's never that crowded. I think it's totally fine. I could probably play a lot more.
And what keeps you from doing it? I mean, I guess I could play a lot more too.
Right. I don't know. I guess playing drums alone was really fun when I was 7 years old, and putting on records, it's less fun now. I have an electronic kit at home in New York, and I will play that every day for 2 minutes. But it's boom, almost boom, like boom, boom. It's almost like playing a video game. It's a totally different thing. Whereas the drums here, they're drums, so it feels like playing drums. It's just not as fun to play alone. It's fun to play with a band. I played with bands for so long. It's fun to connect with people and hear loud guitar amps and all that. And not having that makes it a lot less meaningful.
Yeah, your name still comes up all the time out here when people are standing around talking about all of the musicians. Your name comes up as somebody that just had it, whatever it was.
Oh, man. Maybe I'll be back someday. There's some olds out there doing it these days.
For sure. I thought you meant come back to Seattle, and knowing your wife as little as I do. Yeah, back to drums.
It would be, but I'm not, all kidding aside, I don't know if I'll be in like a real touring band, but I would love to be in a band again someday. And it doesn't feel like, oh, I better do it soon. I'm 53. It really does seem, yeah, maybe when I'm like 60 and I have more time. Like, whatever, it's fine.
No, I see it all the time now. People kind of coming up from our times who quit music and haven't touched the thing in 20 plus years and are now kind of sniffing around and like, why did I ever quit playing music?
Right.
What the hell was I thinking? Playing music is great, and I'm not ready to die. And so I think it's absolutely true that it's always there. Well, I'll tell you what, when I get the Long Winters back together and Matt Hickey gets us some big show.
Yeah.
You know, touring with the reformed Shudder to Think. I guess they're still together right now. I actually put in for the big Postal Service tour and thinking like, hey, you guys are doing a big tour and let me help you out and sell a few tickets in
some of those softer markets. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And they said, well, we're kind of going in a different direction.
Exactly. Yeah. We've got someone who's actually using a Tama bell brass. So it's kind of a crowd pleaser kind of thing.
Well, that concludes Tama bell brass. Episode 1275.PR2225, certificate number 48391 in the omnibus. Futurelings, we highly recommend that you avoid social media. Although, Nabil, you probably are in a line of work where, although you hate social media and can probably have statistics indicating that social media does nothing about moving the needle, you still insist that everybody use it all the time.
I mean, we don't insist, but we strongly recommend.
Is it true that that we're now living in a world where if a band doesn't create basically hourly content, they disappear from the...
It's not true. It's not true.
Okay.
No.
All right.
It can help those who are good at it, and those who are not good at it should just play music.
Right. So what you're saying is the singer should do it and the drummer should...
Or the opposite.
Right. That's right. In our case, it probably would have been the opposite. But if you do want to go on social media, you can find us at the Omnibus Project or Omnibus Project. Fans of the show congregate on Reddit and Discord and Facebook and all other places, even places I've probably never heard of, under the sobriquet Futurelings. And so just put Futurelings in wherever you happen to be. And I bet you there's one or two sentient octopus wandering around there that want to talk about this show and many others. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and we will answer your emails in the fullness of time. But also, you can listen to our monthly addenda show, where we really answer your emails, particularly the complainy ones or the congratulatory ones. And you can find that show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. I recommend that you support the show there, both because the old co-host, who is a millionaire, is gone. And not that he ever put a penny into the show, but, you know, like, I'm really out here floundering. No, I'm not at all. We're doing great. And but if you do support us at patreon.com/omnibusproject, you can have access to all kinds of great bonus material. You can send us mail to care of the Omnibus Project at 609 Southwest 150th Street, Burien, Washington, 98166.
Is that like a mailbox, et cetera, or something?
No, it's actually a post office that I have to go to get the mail. And I have a key and I open a box.
This does not surprise me. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for yet another entry in the Omnibus.